from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The face of American media is changing, and the new poster boy may be Rupert Murdoch. Bare-knuckle politics, profit over news, and above all, give the people what they want. Tonight On Point, the age of Murdoch and the future of the free press in America. First in the week, Americans headed back to work after Labor Day, disquieting bad mixed signals from the job front. New numbers from the Labor Department show that unemployment improved slightly last month, but companies slashed 93,000 jobs from their payrolls. Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I asked him how today's tough news of continuing job losses is being received by economy watchers and the stock market.
It came as a bit of a splash of cold water, Tom. Almost every other indicator we've had on the economy has been very encouraging, very strong sales of automobiles, signs that businesses are starting to invest again. The stock market's been having a good run. And then suddenly we learn that the job market, perhaps the one economic statistic we all care about the most, continues to be just bleak, bleak, bleak. Another loss of jobs in the month of August, the seventh straight month of job loss. The unemployment rate did come down, but just a tick at 6.1%. It's still near the highest in 9 years. Stocks fell on the news. Treasury bonds rose. When bonds rise, that means their rates fall because they're anticipating this means the Fed will not need to raise interest rates for a very long time. But overall, it was definitely in the sort of two steps forward, one step back progress of the economy, a very big step back.
Greg, explain for us, how does the unemployment rate fall, and yet there are job losses at the same time?
There's two reasons it could happen, Tom. The first main reason is that you can have people just giving up looking for work, and so the pool of the labor force shrinks, and there was a little bit of that going on. So in essence, you can have the unemployment rate go down just because some of the unemployed aren't out there being counted as looking for work any longer.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason that can happen is a technical one. The government actually does two surveys. They survey companies and they survey households. And the unemployment rate is drawn from the survey of households, and the number of jobs is drawn from the survey of companies. And you can get different results, partly just because of the statistical noise from 1 month to the next.
Now, there were positive numbers alongside those job losses. What were those, Greg?
Some very, very slim reads to grab a hold of. There was a small increase in temporary employment. In fact, we've had several months of increases in temporary employment. And although a temp staffing job may not be everybody's dream of a working career, it does suggest that firms do want to actually increase employment, and they just don't have the confidence yet to go out there and hire permanent employees. But apart from that, actually, Tom, it was by and large a pretty bleak picture. Another big loss of jobs in manufacturing, a loss of jobs in government, which reflects the ongoing budget crunch for states and municipal governments, losses throughout service producing.
I'm looking at those numbers here, 44,000 manufacturing jobs lost, and this is in 1 month.
Yeah.
Government jobs, 26,000 lost, 28,000 professional services jobs lost. And here I'm looking at a projection of 5 million more American jobs to be lost to other countries by the year 2015. Greg, do we have a crisis developing here around American employment? Is there some deep structural problem with the economy that's producing this hemorrhaging of jobs?
Tom, there's no question that we have both cyclical short-term factors and structural long-term factors at work, and nobody can really say for sure which is dominating the job loss picture, but there's no question they're serious. The loss of manufacturing jobs has been nothing short of astonishing. I think that one in six manufacturing jobs has basically disappeared in the last 3 years. Of course, some of that is because we've had a recession. There's been less demand for, like, big machine tools and other things that we make. But surely much of it is a loss of jobs to countries like China and Latin America and other countries that have much lower labor costs. And more recently, we've also heard that a lot of white-collar jobs have been drained overseas because, for example, in Bombay, you have very good English-speaking people who can operate telemarketing centers at a fraction of the cost that would be charged here in the United States.
Now, for Americans out of work, this clearly doesn't work, but what about for the economy as a whole? Is it possible that we could see positive economic growth at the same time as unemployment staying high and job losses staying high? Is that sustainable, Greg?
Over the long run, no. It's not normal for an economy to keep growing and to not use up the people out there who want to work. People who want to work should, in the fullness of time, be able to find a job.
But what if those companies in this totally globally networked age are growing but hiring overseas?
Well, we should step back for a minute and realize over the past 200 years of this country's history, there's been an ongoing trend of jobs that require less skill, less profession, less education, going to countries with lower education levels and lower salaries. And even within this country, that shift of jobs has been going on forever. It used to be that, like, the majority of people in this country worked on farms. Now it's, like, less than 2%. And manufacturing has been in long-term decline. It's been going on for at least 50 years. And partly that reflects the fact that people in manufacturing can produce the same amount of cars and toys and tools and other things with far fewer hours. That's because productivity has gone up, and that's a very good thing. It means that we can then go and spend more money on other things like vacations and music and so on. So that's a very good, proper thing that over the long run we should applaud.
But if too many people don't have jobs, and if high-paying white-collar jobs are going overseas, can the American standard of living be sustained? What happens to consumer spending? How does that factor into the economy as a whole?
I don't think there's any question that there is a risk that if we continue to have this jobless or job loss type of growth that we've experienced in the last 6 months, you do raise the risk that even though the people who have jobs are more productive and earning more than ever, they will be so worried about their own job prospects that they'll simply snap their wallets shut and raise their savings rates. And if that happens, consumption will decline, and it will not be possible to continue to have this growth that we've had. I think that is definitely a concern. Now, that said, there's something kind of unnatural about the kind of growth we're having being driven entirely from productivity. I really believe that companies have just been very, very reluctant to hire because they want that last bit of proof that this recovery is for real. And I think they're getting that proof, and I think the next few months the employment number will turn around. It just doesn't seem normal that you could go so many months, Tom, without the employment numbers finally responding to what's going on everywhere else in the economy. It doesn't seem very cheerful for those who are without a job now, but I do really think things are going to get better.
Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
Tom, it's always a pleasure.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from Washington. Freedom of the press belongs to those who own one, A.J. Liebling famously wrote, and Rupert Murdoch owns a lot more than one. His company, News Corporation, controls dozens of local TV stations in the U.S., a publishing house, a couple of satellite systems, a string of newspapers and magazines, 20th Century Fox movie studios, and, of course, Fox broadcast networks. And the list may grow if the FCC gets its way. Murdoch is hardly the only big fish in the media pond. But his brash business strategies and taste for political brawling have made him the target of those who see the public interest lost and serious dangers looming in mega media. But it may be that Murdoch's way is the future. Tonight, we look at Rupert Murdoch and the Murdoch model for 21st century media. How do you see it? Fair and balanced, partisan and perilous. If Rupert Murdoch is showing the way, where are we headed with big media in America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from San Francisco is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His piece, The Age of Murdoch, appears in the September issue of the magazine. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, James Fallows.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
It's great to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard Law School. Welcome, Randall Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for being here. James Fallows, take us into this man, Rupert Murdoch, and what you describe as his model. You say he has championed or been the lead example of a new or renewed model of media, of news coverage, of the press. You see, the Murdoch model is winning, maybe has won. What is the Murdoch model, James Fallows?
Well, let me answer that indirectly for a second, if I could. What I was trying to do in this piece is step aside from the normal way of considering Murdoch in the U.S., in U.S. discussion of him, which is essentially he's counted mainly as a political figure. If you like what seem to be his right-wing politics, you're in favor of him. If you don't like them, you think he's part of the great conspiracy against liberals. I wanted to try to look at him the way he looks at himself, which is primarily as a business figure, and see what kind of business he's put together. And it struck me as being, first, distinguished not so much by its size. Murdoch never tires of pointing out that the other three broadcast networks are all part of much bigger conglomerates than his News Corp is.
Viacom, Disney, General Electric.
Exactly. And they all, ABC, General Electric CBS has, you know, several multiples of the total sales of News Corp. But what's unusual about it is its strategic integration, you know, from studios and sports teams all the way up to the physical means of distribution with satellite systems. He has the whole package put together. And it seemed to me that with two guiding premises through his entire life, one is that that news should be considered fundamentally a product like other products. And you give what the market wants, whether it's The Simpsons, whether it's The X-Files, whether it's Bill O'Reilly. If it's popular, you sell it. The other is he is interested in politics, but it seemed to be mainly he uses politics to advance his business ends rather than vice versa. He's primarily interested in making money and expanding his empire rather than electing Republicans.
But this background, this baggage, this Rupert Murdoch comes into an American debate that's gone on for a long time, has become very hot lately with the new FCC actions. Just this last week, of course, the court put a stay to change in FCC regulations that would let big media eat up more media. And as you describe it, and of course many people know it, James Fallows, you've got these two conceptions of the press and its role in public life, and they have collided. Lay those two out for us and show us where Murdoch stands.
Well, there's the two main conceptions. One is the idea that the press basically is different from other businesses. It's the same sort of category as education, as medical care, as religion, as government, which is that, yes, it has commercial purposes. It makes a profit. It has to meet market tests. But fundamentally, it's about something more than simply making money. You know, a toy store is just about making money, but the press is considered to have some kind of public duty. That's why it is uniquely protected by the First Amendment. It's why it enjoys all kinds of liberties other institutions don't have. The other view, which has been prevalent throughout sort of the tabloid press in Europe for a very long time and was really prevalent in the U.S. through about the Gilded Age, was that the press is mainly a business and you sell whatever the market will bear. You give the people what they want. And for 100 years in different guises, in the printed press of the struggle for objectivity that Joseph Pulitzer began, and in the broadcast press with the FCC standards of having fairness and balance and, you know, public decency, et cetera, there's been this struggle to make it something more than just a business. And Murdoch in various ways is taking us back to the purely commercial and more unashamedly partisan nature of the press of 150 years ago.
Not just taking us back, but you say, James Fallows, that the Murdoch model has won.
Yes, and that may be mild, you know, 5% exaggeration for effect. But I think that if you look at the last, say, 25 years of change in the broadcast media, you see all of it becoming fundamentally more market-driven. 25 years ago, the broadcast networks were putting on what they thought of as basically a public service product. And, there was Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley, and they were telling people what they thought the people needed to know. Mm. Now, news broadcasts are another category of infotainment, and they have to meet market tests that are much more rigorous than before. They become much more sort of entertainment-like. And as a result, like every other product in a market economy, we have very, very high-end news products. We have, very sophisticated publications. We have sophisticated broadcast shows. Mm-hmm. But the mass products are more massified than they used to be.
And with that, the market dynamic all over them. Randall Kennedy, this is right at the heart of an enormous debate going on right now around Michael Powell, chairman of the FCC, this stay of recent regulation changes just last week. But here's the big question. If Rupert Murdoch is the new model and he sees the news business as just another business, how does it line up with the Constitution? What does it bode for democracy?
Well, complicated question. On the one hand, the specter of Murdoch is the specter of private power being coercive, private power putting limits on diversity of news and information, private power as a force for bad things happening in America. On the other hand, private power is a counterbalance to governmental power. And so one can understand why people would be somewhat allergic to the idea of government regulation when, after all, it's the Fourth Estate that is supposed to be a watchdog on the government.
But the Fourth Estate has been a watchdog even when it wasn't uber mega media like it is now. Look at Watergate days. Look at the Pentagon Papers. These were big companies back then, but nothing on the scale of Murdoch's empire, of GE, of what we see today. Randall Kennedy, James Fallows, stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the age of Murdoch and the future of the free press in America. Is Rupert Murdoch showing the way for the 21st century news media? Is the Free Press a special public trust, or is it just another big business? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the age of Murdoch and the future of the free press in America. We're joined from San Francisco by James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and with me in the studio tonight, On Point news analyst Randall Kennedy. 1904, Joseph Pulitzer, famous publisher, wrote, "Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. A cynical, mercenary, demagogic press will produce in time a people as base as itself." Words now engraved, as James Fallows reports, over the entrance to the Columbia Journalism School. But where are we headed if Rupert Murdoch is the model? Do you want the FCC to keep a finger of regulatory leverage on Murdoch and the big media companies, or let them run free? And has Murdoch's Fox News paved the way for the return of a partisan press in America, or has it always been a partisan press? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Randall Kennedy, I had to jump in just there before we got to the second piece of that, which is James Fallows raises the traditional notion, which he says more or less dominated for a century, that there was a public trust invested in the press that made it different from other businesses. Do you see it that way? What does it mean for democracy if very big companies see this just as a business? Give the public what they want, never mind the vegetables.
Two things. First of all, I think we have to be very careful about being nostalgic. There's always politics with the press. There was always a political edge. Walter Cronkite might have been very good at submerging his politics, but he had a political slant. I kind of like, frankly, the partisanship, the more explicit, the more overt ideological edge that is shown on Fox. I'm against its politics. But it's clear, at least.
And it's up front.
It's up front, and I think that's good. So there's a part of me that actually likes what's going on with the Murdoch empire.
James Fallows, how do you see that? You describe the future of the American media perhaps as something more like the European media, where everybody knows the politics of any given television station or especially newspaper, and they factor that in as they listen. Is that the part and parcel of the Murdoch model? Is that where we're headed?
I think that may be where – part of my argument is that is something more like where we're headed. And I think that in the sort of increasing market stratification and having a product for every niche, there will probably be a niche for some publications that still struggle to seem objective. And I think on both the points that Randall Kennedy was making, both on the objectivity – well, the related point to objectivity and partisanship, the significant thing of the last 100 years was the struggle to have the pretense of both objectivity and public service. Mm-hmm. And I think that struggle may be people are going to spend less time on that effort. They have, of course, always had their political views. But if the U.S. is returning to what it had before the 1880s, what Europe has had all along of a sort of openly Republican and Democratic right-wing and left-wing press, that will survive that.
But where does that leave the public interest? Can the market sort this out? Will the market bring the public the full range of information, of perspectives that they need as citizens to make good decisions?
Well, the reason the press has been considered as an unusual good, not just another market service, is there are all these externalities. If the press is vulgar, the public becomes vulgar. It doesn't know enough about candidates. And I think we can see the trend if we look at cable news these days. When there is a war on, cable news covers that to saturation level, and you get a lot of, often good reporting. When there's not a war on or something of that sort, cable news is finding anything else to treat the same way. And for the last few years, it's been JonBenet Ramsey. It was OJ before that. It's been Lacey Peterson recently, things of not really that transcendent public interest. And so the spectacle quality of public attention, that's what we get much, much more of. And that is a loss. And we'll have to find some other way to accommodate, the public education function the press at sometimes has played.
Well, that's easy to say, but part of the point here, isn't it, with the FCC debate is that if mega media kind of swallow up all the options, there aren't many options.
Well, I think there an argument I'll say in defense of Michael Powell, whom I actually sympathize with. I think he's really has ended up in a terrible situation over this recent ruling. He makes the point that in principle there are more options now than ever before in human history. The motivated news seeker in America these days can find more news from radio stations, from blogs, from internet sites, from specialized publications, from you name it, than any other human being in history. So if you want to look for things, you can find them. The question is what served up kind of automatically in the main channels. And that's becoming more homogenized. But to my mind, the diversity is actually sort of less significant than the spectacle nature of it. If you want to look for stuff, it's there. But the main fare is pretty lowbrow.
James Fallows, Randall Kennedy, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Mark Cooper. He joins us from Silver Springs, Maryland. He's Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America. He's author of Media Ownership and Democracy in the Digital Information Age. Good evening and welcome, Mark Cooper.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Mark Cooper, James Fallows has put the magnifying glass on Rupert Murdoch and comes up seeing him and his media empire is potentially the model, perhaps already the model, for American media now and in this century. What's the significance? What's the consequence if that's the case?
Well, the interesting consequence is that, in a certain sense, our society can control the kind of media we get by establishing not regulations over content, which was suggested, but structural regulation over ownership.
And this is what the FCC has done since the 30s.
There's been a 20-year campaign to turn news and information into a commodity, and that has been ongoing to remove the limits on ownership, to allow people to own more and more stations. The end point of that is you get what you wish for if you allow concentration of ownership, conglomeration, consolidation, international chains.
Well, James Fallows agrees with you there. I mean, he concludes saying in the long run, the press gives the public what it wants, but is that the way we ought to be going here?
Well, no, it's absolutely not where we ought to be going. And the Supreme Court, in a landmark decision in 1945, declared that the public interest lies in the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources. In that decision, Justice Frankfurter said specifically, news is not a commodity like peanuts or potatoes. And that became the basis for a series of structural regulations that did not allow this to happen. The purpose of democratic discourse is not profit and efficiency. It is the debate and ultimately an understanding of, and truth. And so the whole driving dynamic of civic discourse can and should be different from the economics. You have to pay some attention to economics, but Rupert Murdoch, if he was not allowed to own two TV stations in a number of towns, if he was not allowed to own a newspaper where he owns a TV station, would still make plenty of money, as would the independent newspapers.
Oh, okay, of course, you say the discourse should be apart to some extent from those economics, but the fact is it takes place largely in the media. The media has become more concentrated. Rupert Murdoch simply doesn't agree with this interpretation of where the public interest sits in the news media. As James Fallows points out, he sees it as a business, and James Fallows says this model is winning. Where are we headed?
Well, the model is winning as a matter of political choice, and that's what you're seeing in Congress today. That's what you have seen with the movement to prevent the relaxation of the rules. And the interesting thing is we will have a Supreme Court decision down the road out of these rules about whether essentially that interpretation, what we call the bold aspiration for the First Amendment, is still the law of the land. I mean, there will be this challenge. There's another thing that has been missed in this, and it came up at the very end when we were talking about all these choices people have as listeners.
Mm-hmm.
In point of fact, First Amendment jurisprudence has always been driven not by the freedom of listening, but the freedom of speech. And that's what's been missed in this. Every time the Supreme Court revisits this, they ask the question with respect to the electronic media, what are the numbers of electronic voices? What are the number of broadcast licenses available? And what they always find is that a very small number of people can control those broadcast licenses, And that leaves the rest of the citizenry without an electronic voice. And that has always been the basis for saying that broadcast license is not an unabridgeable right to say what you want.
But, of course, that broadcast realm is only a piece of it now. You've got all kinds of digital outlets that are not broadcast, and that's part of the diversity, the number of outlets people are speaking to. Randall Kennedy, do you see the walls coming in on public discourse here, opening wide? And what about this notion of the public discourse as to be exempt from commodification?
I think it's a complicated picture. On the one hand, technology is opening things up considerably more. On the other hand, we do have this concentration that's giving rise to this show this evening. One thing I'd say about our colleague's last comment, we're talking about the electronic media, but of course, newspaper ownership is concentrated. There are many, many cities and towns around the country that where one company owns both papers, but nobody there is talking about putting the government in a position to regulate things. I think we have to be very careful about government regulation insofar as Big Brother has to be met by a truly independent counterweight.
But we're not talking here about adding new regulations that are outside precedent of history. This is about stripping away the bit of regulation that is there. Has Big Brother been in charge for the last 70 years?
I'm sorry?
Has Big Brother been in charge ever since the FCC began to play a role in the distribution of bandwidth for radio signal?
Well, let's break this down a bit. When we say Big Brother, Big Brother is all of us, the government. I mean, all of this is a matter of public policy, and it's really up to us to decide how we want our society structured. And all I'm saying is that we have a real balancing act. On the one hand, we don't want to have just a few moguls controlling everything and perhaps limiting us. On the other hand, we don't want to put ourselves in a position of so cutting back on the moguls that private companies are not in a position to buck the government.
Mark Cooper, do you see a danger of that?
Well, the fundamental difference between newspapers, which nobody licenses in America, and TV stations and radio stations is that they have almost always been licensed. And there may come a time, this is the interesting thing about the internet and perhaps unlicensed spectrum, when every American can have an electronic voice. That isn't the case today. I've offered the networks the following proposition. If they think the internet is the equal of their electronic licenses, then they should give them back and distribute their programming over the internet. And they, of course, know that the internet as a distribution medium is not nearly as powerful as their very valuable frequencies. But there might come a time where technology enables every citizen to have that sort of voice. But the fundamental constraint on the electronic media and the fundamental observation of the Supreme Court for the last 60 years is to recognize that these electronic voices are uniquely powerful and uniquely scarce, and until that scarcity has genuinely been eroded, they are a source of inordinate leverage and therefore need to be subject not to content regulation. I actually endorse the concept of a partisan press, but the important point is that if you're going to have a partisan press, you must make sure that there is a dispersion of opportunity to speak. And that is what we're losing. And I agree with Randall at this last point.
James Fallows, I want to get you in here. One citizen who's already having an awful lot of influence over this and who will have more, originally an Australian but now also an American citizen, is, of course, Rupert Murdoch. Give us a sense of this man, his kind of nutshell bio and the perspective that he brings to driving this business, which you say is creating its own kind of magnetism, its own kind of model as he goes.
I'd like to do that. And could I take 20 seconds before that just to make a point relative to what we're discussing? A minor point and then a sort of thematic point. The specific point is that conceptually there could be a million broadcast stations fairly soon through the medium of streaming web content. I mean, each of us could effectively set up our own broadcast stations. That's a way around the sort of physical constraint of spectrum. Now, the larger point I'd like to make is we've seen the last, say, 15 years in the former Soviet Empire, the expansion of market forces, which we generally welcome as an alternative to the command economy. We've also had in the last 25 years in the Western economy, market forces being applied to places traditionally were sheltered from them, from medical care to education to the media. And I think we just have to figure out how far we want that marketization to go. The point of my article was it's going pretty far and that its natural trend is just to be purely market-driven, and the only thing that will stop it is some kind of public discourse. Murdoch, in brief, he comes from a sort of modest Australian newspaper dynasty. His father had a chain of newspapers in Australia. His father pioneered the idea of combining newspaper and radio to have this kind of technological combo. Murdoch came to the U.S. about 25 years ago and has had a quite shrewd eye for the combination of technological leverage of using. He was very early into satellites. He has has them in Asia and in Europe. He has these very effective satellite networks. Mm-hmm. The most important acquisition he has here is of DirecTV. Nothing to do with this recent FCC controversy. Mm-hmm. So he's been technologically sophisticated. He has an extremely shrewd eye for what popular taste is, and so Fox Broadcast has lots of sort of left wing content, or at least anti-traditional values content. Fox News Channel,
their entertainment side, that is.
Yes, their entertainment side. That 70s show, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire, the glorious Simpsons, the great work of modern popular culture, et cetera. So it's been a matter of technological sophistication, a taste for the mass market, and currying political favors wherever he can. And just to mention briefly, his press has been as important a pro-Tony Blair influence in England as it has been anti-Bill Clinton in the U.S. In both cases, the constant factor is the party he's helped has also helped him.
That is, he favored the more liberal party in England. He opposed the more liberal, or Bill Clinton anyway, in the United States. But how about that, James Fallows? If Rupert Murdoch were perceived in the States not as a conservative, which I think he generally is, do you think that the Murdoch model would be greeted with such trepidation and public uproar?
I think there is the liberal America's horror of Murdoch is sort of channeling onto one person liberal America's horror of the way politics in the last 10 or 15 years has gone. And it's similar to the furor during the FCC ruling recently. As Mark Cooper well knows, Rupert Murdoch was not at the heart of that decision. He had some minor impact on his holdings by that decision, but he wasn't fundamentally at the heart of it. But he is sort of a very convenient and evocative symbol of things that people don't like. And so if people in America knew that he were a big supporter of Tony Blair in England, it might make them a little bit confused. But he still sort of is a distillation of things they haven't liked about the political combat of the last 15 years.
Mark Cooper, just a few seconds before the break here, but how do you see it 20 years out? Is the Murdoch model the winning model, or is it still a real political question to be decided politically? Will the market drive it?
Well, I think it's a real political question, primarily because the Supreme Court will make a decision about the extent to which pure economics rules. And the people I talk to who do the vote counting on the Supreme Court are not clear on where it'll come out. The Supreme Court has fooled us recently on the affirmative action on the gay rights decision.
So it could still be a surprise there.
It could go either way.
Either way. Mark Cooper, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Mark Cooper is Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America. We're talking about the age of Murdoch and the future of the free press in America. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the age of Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, and the future of the free press in America. My guest is James Fallows. He's national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. His article, The Age of Murdoch, appears in the September issue of that magazine. I'm with Randall Kennedy here in the studio as well. You can join us also. Does the Murdoch media model leave a healthier democracy or a manipulated public? Are laissez-faire economics enough to ensure a vigorous, serious, free press? And if Murdoch is showing the way, where are we headed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Washington, D.C. by Michael Gettler, Ombudsman for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Michael Gettler.
Good evening.
Good to have you. You've heard some of our conversation tonight. James Fallows looks into the empire of Rupert Murdoch and looks into the future, and he sees a press more purely commercial, more openly partisan. He sees the Murdoch model as essentially having already essentially won. What do you think of that assessment, Michael Gettler? Is that where we're headed?
Well, I think I'm an admirer of Jim Fallows and his work, and I think we are headed in that direction. I wouldn't say purely commercial and openly partisan. I think it's more commercial and more partisan than perhaps it's been in the last 50 years. But I, you know, perhaps naively believe that there will remain a core. Certainly in the newspaper field, which is really the only field that I know well, will remain a core of newspapers that do work very hard at trying to remain nonpartisan, and with publishers and owners who, while continuing to be successful financially, will have a sense of public service and not have an excessive drive for profits and profit margins obscure the reason that they have printing presses.
And Michael Gettler, if that's the case, if that core goes on, is that enough? If it's surrounded by a very large media that is commercially driven, fairly purely commercially driven, in terms of what a democracy needs, does that balance work?
Well, it's probably not enough, but it seems to me that the established networks still fight the good fight to present a fair and balanced and nonpartisan newscast, and hopefully that will continue. I hope that there's certainly a large enough segment of the public which will demand that.
James Fallows, how about it? Michael Gettler says perhaps he's naive. By your analysis, he may be.
No, he's anything but naive. But I think his point is correct. And I was trying to say there's going to be a variegated news, economy and ecology for a long time. And some publications will have as their market distinction that they do try to be nonpartisan. But I think it's quite significant that the two leading national papers, or two of three, the New York Times and the Washington Post, and to a degree the Wall Street Journal, they're insulated from some of these commercial their pressures because they have a strong family influence in them. They're not, just corporations. The historic families that have run them are able to say, okay, we're going to hold back from, maximizing profits in this degree because we think there's some kind of public service. So they can remain, they might for that reason remain some exception for some time to this economic trend.
Mm. Let's turn to our callers. Dana's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
I would like to open my remarks by saying that I think very often free market is conflated with democracy. And so in that context, I would answer your question, no, free market, the so-called free market is an enemy to an enemy to a healthy democracy because free market.
But free market and the United States are pretty well grown up hand in hand. Are you saying particularly in the media area or if it's all market focused?
Well, I'll keep it to the media, because that's what we're talking about tonight. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think it's especially since if the market isn't regulated and they don't have to – they can they're free to marginalize views they don't agree with, and which is often the left in this case. And, and I think Rupert Murdoch model is an insult and a danger to democracy, although, ironically enough, as I was telling your screener, sometimes Murdoch has been more – fair and balanced, pardon that, than NPR has, because at least once in a while on some of the Fox News panels, at least someone from the left is invited onto the panel, like I think his name is Seth Ackerman from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And you never hear voices like that on so-called public radio, which I think is a misnomer these days.
Well, I wonder about that. Listen closely. Listen to this show, Dana. But we take your point, this concern about free market and democracy in the media living side by side. Of course, they have for a long time, Michael Gettler. But I wonder if there is a real culture shift And James Fallows describes Rupert Murdoch as driving this dynamic that other media companies have to look at. If over time, you know, as families can fade away from ownership, old traditions can fall by the wayside, can you imagine some decades out in American media where that notion of, call it noblesse oblige or public interest, what you will, is just kind of ground out by market dynamics?
Well, it certainly could happen, and I just hope it does not happen. I still have enough faith in the population and the news consumer that over time, even if there is a swing to more and more politicized and commercialized so-called news operations, that at some point it'll swing back, because you can't, it seems to me, you can't function very well without news outlets that you really trust, and that the trust is derived from a sense of fairness, a sense that people are, that you're being presented with news without a political spin on it, but factual information and broad kinds of commentary and analysis that take all sides. I really would fear for the future of our for our future if that disappears.
Michael Gettler, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Michael Gettler is ombudsman for the Washington Post, former executive editor of the International Herald Tribune. James Fallows, I ended up wondering exactly where you come down with Rupert Murdoch. I felt a kind of admiration running through this piece, and maybe even an admiration for his approach toward the media. The thought that, hey, this guy is just out there mixing it up, and there's a kind of vigor of its own in his focus, in his energy, in his determination to build a big Murdoch business.
Well, I think you accurately sort of read my mind. And I found myself, it was a interesting and puzzling and perplexing process to go through. I don't personally agree with very many of Rupert Murdoch's political views. I don't agree with a lot of what's on Fox News. And I was not treated very well by the Fox empire when I was trying to do this story. They stiff-armed me for seeing Murdoch, and so I had to kind of sneak in and see him in odd ways. Fox News, the Fox Broadcast Network has this, the Fox News Channel has this preposterous rule that it won't let any of its employees or reporters talk to the press, you know, unless they have, you know, screening and a monitor. It just seems insane for a news operation. Yeah. Nonetheless, there are a couple of things I admired. I did admire sort of his technological skill. I admired it just as a business. There's sort of a shark-like efficiency to it that you have to marvel at. Murdoch, as a billionaire, among billionaires, he seems to be one of the nicer ones personally. At least that's what is said within his empire, that people don't resent him, they don't make fun of him. And anybody who's worked in a news business knows how often they are filled with people who moan and whine and complain. And the Murdoch properties don't seem very much that way. The people seem to have a kind of bounce in their step. They feel as if they are part of the vanguard of history, and maybe that's why I was conveying that feeling.
But about beyond the emotion, the model itself, reading between the lines, you're saying maybe we can go with this. Maybe the Murdoch model's okay.
Well, it's, you know, I personally have, you know, argued in the past that the country really does suffer if all the public service elements of the news are neglected for market forces. And I still do believe that. I think that there is an important democratic function that the news serves. But I was impressed enough by the robustness of what this organization has put together and the demonstration effect that Fox News in particular has had on CNN, on MSNBC, and even on the broadcast news channels to think that this is, you know, an example that the competitors can't ignore. It is in the Darwinian competition, it's proving itself more vital.
James Fallows, you keep us thinking, and we thank you very much for joining us again tonight. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. Well, Randall, admiration. I was flipping through the cable realm last night. Citizen Kane was on, and there he was with his great empire. Now we have admiration for a new big media mogul.
I want to pick up on this word that Mr. Fallows used, robustness. And I think it ought to be remembered how robust our culture is. I'm really not much worried by the Murdoch phenomenon, because we live in a very large country, and there's going to be a response to Murdochism. And as long as there's a response, as long as we have a culture that is buoyant and that leaves lots of room and fluidity for people to respond to things that come up, we'll be in okay shape.
Very big country, very big media. We'll watch this space. Randall Kennedy, thank you for being with us tonight. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, innovative ways to make ends meet in a tough economy. This is On Point. Mixed news on American unemployment from the Labor Department today. New figures show that while American employers continued to trim payroll jobs in August, the nation's unemployment rate ticked slightly lower last month. But Americans who have jobs haven't been able to escape tough economic times either. Lisa Rentz owns a bakery in South Carolina. While the bakery is still open, the sluggish economy has hurt her small business. In this radio diary, Lisa Rentz describes the unorthodox means she has resorted to in order to make ends meet.
The soft economy that news people mention many times a day hasn't got me wondering about the security of my job or the deficit and the cost of war or the splendor of low interest rates. It's got me selling my things, my personal stuff, to pay my bills. It's like being a Hugo character and trying to sell my only untorn frock for bread while the revolution rages. I rationalize this budget-building tactic by recognizing the fact that I have more than enough belongings. My husband and I have 1940s lamps, 1900s mantel clocks, English wedding china never used, a reproduction medieval Italian crossbow. Nothing matches, but it's all memories and associations of where we lived when I bought the face jug, or of the best ever church rummage sale where I found the blue and white enamel Swedish Canton pot in which I have since cooked nothing. After 10 years of accumulation, we opened an artisan bread bakery in the summer of 2001. It has always been, ominously, the first Bush administration and the first Gulf War that my husband blames for his first business failure. But for the past 2 years, even as my own tech stocks attained true lack of value, unemployment rose, and bread sales plummeted, I didn't believe my husband or the news people. How could the vast market economy, Alan Greenspan, or the policies of an administration that displays no concern for little old lower-class me, affect our tiny handmade bakery situated on the coast of a southern no-account state? The U.S. of A. is not even to the east of us, just dolphins and calm, cool international waters as far as the eye can see. We work hard and nothing can touch us, I thought. I tend to blame our shop's much too modest success on my crankiness with customers, my aversion to the hard sell, and the fact that everyone else seems to misunderstand the value and helpfulness of handmade breads. Diabetics and Atkinsers alike will tell me that they can't eat bread, then ask for a cinnamon roll. But now I'm actually selling my personal belongings to help pay bills. I feel the squeeze of this economy, see the pattern in the politics, and want to place blame too, as if blame will help now. I supplement our bank account with 1997's summer of accumulation in Boone, North Carolina, 2000's trip to Atlanta, a green and cream polka dot silk suit that I wore once in 1999, and my lifelong fondness for thrift stores. My things now have more value than pretty shelf sitting, or stylish closet hanging, or questionable decor supplementing. The 6-foot-tall, inflatable vinyl Gumby that my husband bought at a Spencer's in 1983 has a new home in Japan. The inflatable toy collector and I met through the online auction service I have recently grown so fond of. The face jug that I bought on the freezing day of a kiln opening, right out of the hands of the blind mountain man who made it, sold for twice what I paid for it. The garish bent metal flowering chandelier that hung in our kitchen nook for 8 months after being rescued from a thrift store went for $62 plus shipping. It relieves my pounding head to pay my bills, and my new philosophy is out of sight, out of mind. I refuse to miss things. It is certainly embarrassing to talk about personal finances. What I am doing now is pulling a reverse materialism maneuver, trading pretenses at a tax bracket for gratifying, live-action experience. I meet people far outside my little town, I realize how temporary ownership is, and I will find it much lighter to move next time around. I recognize that things change in many senses. Someday, enough people will lose enough weight and want to eat bread again, and someday, enough of the people will affect a permanent, healthy, eco-political change for themselves and this country. I can't wait to hear what my new coworkers at my second job think of things.
Lisa Rentz is a baker and writer and co-owner of the Twice Baked Bread Company. She lives in Beaufort, South Carolina. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.